It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 2018 was the region's wettest year on record, triggering dozens of landslides, forcing people out of their homes, costing the city millions in repairs. As a result, Mayor Bill Peduto's 2019 budget calls for $6.8 million to go towards landslide repair and prevention in the region, tripling the amount allocated last year. Joe Boward is a geotechnical engineer and president of Garvin Boward Beatco Incorporated. Quite familiar with landslide abatement. Joe, welcome to the Confluence.
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
Joe, as you know, last night we had another reminder. Two houses along Arlington Avenue in the city were evacuated due to a mudslide down a steep hill. Joe, I want to start off with, what is the role of an engineer after a slide occurs?
Well, for a geotechnical engineer, obviously the first thing we're going to do is visit the site to try to get a hold on exactly what we're walking into, the threat to the welfare of the public, because that is one of the first things a professional engineer takes into account. If there's a structure, a house, a dwelling that's threatened, we are going to evaluate that and perhaps recommend that they remove themselves from that dwelling. But after that, then it's a process of analyzing and evaluating the landslide and determining either the cause or the remedial measures that need to be undertaken.
So does that all happen before the cleanup, determining the cause? Or is that in conjunction with
it? Not always. It sort of depends on the situation. The cause has to be taken into account even when you're developing your remedial measures, because you have to understand what you're trying to fix. But sometimes the cause is more involved in litigatory problems. They are looking at using me as an expert witness. But the end result is somewhere along the line, somebody's going to want to fix that landslide. So, yeah, that typically happens before too much cleanup has taken place.
Right. We mentioned at the top that the wettest year on record for this region last year. Is it strictly weather? Is it strictly precipitation? What can cause the landslides?
Well, last year was an unusually wet year, and I think that was a major factor in the number of landslides we had. But that is not by itself the only triggering mechanism for landslides. Landslides are triggered by typically four elements, at least in this region. One of them is cutting at the toe of the hillside, because you're removing the resistance, helping to support that hillside. Another one is adding a surcharge load to the top.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you have a particular hillside that maybe is marginally stable to begin with, and you build a large structure at the top without taking that into account, you've just put a load at the top of the slope, which is going to tend to want to drive the slope and cause movements. The third factor would be it's water, which we've talked about the precipitation. It can be groundwater, it can be stormwater, but it's adding water to a slope, increasing the water. And then the final one would be vibrations, such as from an earthquake or uncontrolled blasting or something like that.
Okay. What about, water main breaks come into play?
Yes, that would be the third factor where you're adding water to a slope. They can definitely play a role in landslides. One of the chicken and egg problems we have sometimes, though, is once a landslide occurs and the water line's broken, is it the water line that caused the landslide, or did the landslide itself cause the water line to break? So sometimes that's pretty difficult for us to determine which came first, was the actual cause.
Mm-hmm. Can you look at an area and say, uh-oh, that could slide?
Yes. I am not, I don't have a crystal ball, but as a geotechnical engineer, I've had a lot of education and training that I can look at a slope and often be able to see that there is a stability issue there. There's various signs I can look for.
Do we do much of that, though? Is sort of really scouting it out, whether it's testing or just examination, so that we can be prepared for a potential slide, or maybe even take some steps to lessen the impact?
If it's a project, say a new development or a highway, there is a standard of care for engineers. And yes, the geotechnical engineer should scout that area. There's a process they go through looking at mapping and perhaps most of the time performing test borings. So there is a process for that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Everybody knows, anybody that's been in this town for any length of time knows that Pittsburgh is known for its hilly neighborhoods, Troy Hill, Mount Washington, Southside Slopes, just to name a few. Is there anything that residents can do to decrease the chances of something like this happening on their property?
Yeah, it is a difficult question. Many of the areas in Pittsburgh are susceptible to sliding due to various subsurface conditions and other triggering factors. As far as what they can do, they can perhaps put themselves at ease or at least understand the condition of their property by engaging a geotechnical engineer or geologist, a professional geologist, to take a look at their property and see if some of those signs exist and see how their property maps. As far as preventing it, that would be the next step at looking at potential mitigatory factors, which can get expensive.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about that, the cost of it, the cost to the city, the cost to individual homeowners. I mentioned before, can you see it? Is there are there just regular viewings, examinations? Is there anything that an amateur, just a homeowner, can do that might be, they might spot something unusual that might cause them some concern or to, you know, contact a professional?
Yes, there is a few things a homeowner can do as a layperson. For instance, if you have a home that's a low sidewalk where you have a slope, say, falling away from your rear yard of your dwelling, you want to keep your eye on that slope, especially the top of the slope. If you see cracks in the ground, they're called ground tension cracks, mm-hmm. and those are an indication that that your slope might be starting to move. And there's other things they can look for. Just keep an eye on it, become familiar with the slope. So if you see something unusual, a tree leaning or something like that, then you can at least contact a professional.
Obviously, you've had plenty of experience with landslides contracted by the County Department of Public Works. You have your own company now. Was 2018 an anomaly? Was it the year of the landslides? Have you seen increases over the course of, say, the last decade or so?
2018 was unusually active with respect to landslides. Our firm was pretty much overwhelmed with landslide type of projects. And I would say that it's a potential anomaly. It certainly is with respect to the amount of precipitation we had. The only qualifier I have with respect to that is with the climate change conditions that I feel we are experiencing, I don't know how much this is going to continue into the future.
Mm-hmm. Freeze-thaw?
Freeze-thaw is another situation. Last year, we had an unusual condition, and we're starting to see it this year as well, where we had big swings in temperature, went from 50 degrees to 20 degrees over and over, and that type of cycle causes freeze-thaw, which increases the risk of landsliding.
City and county spent millions responding to landslides last year. That doesn't account for, I guess, maybe even half of the damage, and because a lot of the damage is to private residences, private property. What are the typical costs in general for repairs for a property owner?
That varies quite widely. For a property owner, it can be very prohibitive. Just for me to analyze it, if we're getting to the point that we're trying to remediate a landslide, I'm going to need to do test borings. So you're probably talking to $8,000 to $20,000 range just for me to analyze it. That's before you fix it. And then to fix it, it depends on the measures you undertake to fix it. But you could be looking at $25,000 to hundreds of thousands of dollars to remediate a landslide.
All right. So I live in maybe a susceptible neighborhood, live in a hilly condition. So I just get some insurance, right, or not? Is insurance going to take care of this?
I am aware of no insurance company that will insure for land movement. There is no insurance I'm aware of. Unfortunately, there is no program for that. There's been talk in Pennsylvania for many years of developing a fund for that, but it has not taken place.
All right. Well, we've addressed mine subsidence, haven't we, as a state, or our governments have addressed mine subsidence. Do you think that landslides might be on the radar of our elected officials?
It has been on the radar periodically, but it's never seen any real movement. And I can't speak for our political figures, but I would I would think that considering the cost of landslides, damage to property, and the threat to homeowners, that there perhaps should be more action taken on that front.
All right. One more question about insurance. What happens if your slide maybe damages a neighbor? Is there any protection there?
Yes, there is. That's a little bit different situation. That's where the liability kicks in. On most insurance policies, that if your landslide encroaches into a neighbor's property, there may be a route for your insurance company now. What they're going to want to do is just fix the damages to your neighbor's property. That's what they're doing. They're not trying to fix the slide. However, with a landslide, typically the only way you can fix the damage to the neighbor's property is to fix the landslide. So that is one potential loophole that homeowners can take advantage of. But if it occurred on your property and hasn't affected your neighbor's property, you're out of luck with that.
All right. We mentioned the large number of slides last year in the Pittsburgh area and the county. How are we as a region? Do you look at other areas, other states, other regions in terms of landslides, the number?
I am aware of some of the landslides in the United States. Obviously, I don't know every region and every area. But Southwest Pennsylvania is unusual. It has more landslides, not just Southwest Pennsylvania, but parts of West Virginia and the surrounding areas. It has more landslides per square mile than pretty much any other area in the continental United States. Now, they're not as sensational as the landslides we see in California and some mm-hmm. other areas. But as far as the number of slides, it's really disproportional.
Is that good for business owners like yourself?
Yeah, it's sad that I take advantage of these situations. But somebody has to be out there to help help these people that are having these landslides and to come up with solutions. And it does help our business, yes.
In our last 30 seconds or so, you can clean up after a slide. You can stabilize. Can you fully prevent one?
There is ways to prevent a landslide, but you have to first know that you have a problem. And sometimes people don't want to spend money on fixing something that's not really broken yet. There are measures you can take, though, to prevent a landslide.
And we have seen in our area some massive walls along some state highways like Route 28 in the Millville North Side area.
So that's right, yes. Those walls are really necessary to protect the public, the health and safety of the public driving on those roads.
Joe Boward is the principal engineer and president of Garvin Boward Beatco Incorporated. Joe, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed myself.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Each year on February 7th, music lovers all over the world observe International Clash Day, an annual celebration of the seminal UK punk band The Clash and a recognition of the enduring influence of their music and their human rights message.
London calling to the faraway towns, now war is declared and battle come down.
The Clash always wore their politics on their sleeves, pushing left-wing ideologies and speaking for those who didn't have a voice. They even resisted the machine that made the money, keeping the prices of concert tickets, souvenirs, and records low for their fans. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
You may have heard about the Green New Deal, but what is it? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier. House Democrats are preparing to unveil specifics around the Green New Deal, a sweeping set of policies that would transform the American economy in an era of climate change. But what is this plan, and why are some activists so adamant that we enact it? For our podcast, Trump on Earth, we talked about the Green New Deal with Alexander Kaufman, a reporter for the HuffPost who covers climate change. He said the goal of the Green New Deal is to enact policies to go to a zero-carbon economy in a matter of just a few years.
Some people say 2030. Other people say that's not as realistic, and so we should push for 2035. But that's the kind of time frame that we're looking at for that. The other aspect of it is potentially using a federal jobs guarantee, which is something that FDR had considered in the New Deal but wasn't able to accomplish, and which is something that has actually been proposed by a number of different Democratic senators who are running for president. And that policy has not been explicitly tied to green jobs necessarily. But if you look at polling and if you talk to some of the people who are pushing for a Green New Deal, they say that that is one of the most important things, because we need to be able to guarantee that people who are impacted by this radical overhaul of the way that the economy functions need to be guaranteed that they will have good paying jobs that they can continue to feed their families with.
What types of things do we expect to come out of not even the Republican Party, but also kind of more moderate Democrats of this policy or this idea?
Well, you can expect a lot of skepticism. I mean, there has not been full-throated support from Democratic leadership for something like this, in part because they are beholden not necessarily to the Cokes of the world or to the Exxons of the world, but certainly to the building trades, who really depend on the fossil fuel industry for very lucrative jobs. You know, it's notable that the renewable energy industry is not organized. Overwhelmingly, it is non-union labor that builds a lot of the windmills and a lot of the solar panels in the United States. So that's a big problem for the Democrats.
Do you think, when you think about the Green New Deal, that this will require some sort of fundamental change in how people live their lives or how society is structured?
Quitting fossil fuels will require a dramatic change. You know, fossil fuels are really entwined in almost every aspect of our lives. You know, the plastic that we use, the cars that we drive, the airplanes that we take to go from place to place. But there's a lot of hope among people that if you were to really aggressively invest in these new industries, that, you know, in theory, you know, you could easily have someone go and get a job in this booming and federally backed clean energy industry. I don't necessarily think that it requires voluntary hardship from the average person in order to keep the planet from becoming uninhabitable.
Alexander Kaufman covers climate change for the HuffPost. Hear the rest of the interview at TrumpOnEarth.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh author Jonah Winter wants to make the Founding Fathers, the Voting Rights Act, and the Supreme Court more accessible to kids. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins spoke with Winter ahead of his Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures talk this weekend. He said his books highlight the facts he thinks are left out of the history books.
The way Thomas Jefferson is taught to children, by and large, most of the children's books make no reference to his paternity of Sally Hemings' children. Sally Hemings was an enslaved person who was owned by him and was the mother of four of his children. This is left out of the history books because here in this country, we want to protect the idea of Thomas Jefferson as this unapproachable figure whose main legacy were the words, "All men are created equal," though his life was a total contradiction of that premise. One of the books I dealt with this in was a book called The Founding Fathers! And this whole book is just a compendium of facts about the most famous of the Founding Fathers. For instance, George Washington was the only president to lead his troops in battle, and it was against his own people here in the state of Pennsylvania during the famous Whiskey Rebellion. So those are the sorts of facts that I want to get across to children in my books.
And how do they, what is their response?
It's hard to say, because I think sometimes it takes children a while to fully absorb what they have listened to or heard from me in my introductions to them when I'm visiting their schools. I mean, a lot of times the questions they ask me are, what's your favorite color? Like, I'll have given this long and passionate talk about justice and women's rights and, you know, and who the founding fathers were and voting rights and the fact that only white men were allowed to vote. And then they'll ask me if I have a dog.
I want to talk to you about one of your more recent books. It's called Ruth Bader Ginsburg, The Case of RBG versus Inequality. Can you talk about the process that you went through to make the Supreme Court and a Supreme Court justice an accessible idea for kids? I mean, we have a really opaque, complex legal system in our country, too.
Most of my book is the story of who she was before she became a Supreme Court justice and deals with all sorts of prejudice. She dealt with both anti-Semitic prejudice, but largely misogynist prejudice. And the sorts of details that I talk about in the book are things that any child could understand. By the time I get to the part where she becomes a Supreme Court justice, I do try to simplify extremely sophisticated topics.
One thing I did want to ask you about, I mean, you have touched on this idea of filling in the gaps in history that kids and the people reading these books to them aren't focusing on. And a lot of those stories are about women and of people of color. And you are neither of those things. And I'm just curious how you feel your identity
affects.
Affects
my relationship to the subject matter.
Yeah, and affects how you choose who you're going to write about.
I think that the topic, I mean, I write a lot about racism in my books, and I think racism is both a black and white topic, involves two different sides, but it is, if it's one more than the other, it's a white topic. And I come from a part of the country that where there's, you know, the Confederacy was. There's some pretty bad things in my ancestry. I think it is my duty as a citizen to try, as a white person, to try to make this world a better place, to educate children about these things. And it's precisely because of my identity that I write the sort of books that I do. Without writing about people who are different from us, all we're left with is memoir. And I don't know. I don't think that would make literature very interesting if that was all we were ultimately left with, which is what some people, I think, would like it to be.
That's 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins speaking with author Jonah Winter. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. When it comes to pizza, we all know Chicago has deep dish, New York has a thin, foldable crust. But what about Pittsburgh-style pizza? One listener asked us to find out what sets the Steel City's pies apart. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Kovash explores the dish for our Good Question series.
It's a Wednesday afternoon, about an hour until Vincent's Pizza Park in Forest Hills opens for business.
So basically, you pull out whatever size dough patty, and you have to pat it. And then there's the art of pie tossing.
Owner Lisa Zollner is stretching out dough, ladling sauce, and grabbing handfuls of Vinny's signature heaping piles of toppings.
Garlic, please! Okay, you like garlic, right? Because, like I said, we're not light on the toppings here.
Once out of the oven, you're greeted with an oblong pizza that has a hearty, thick crust, no shortage of cheese, and lots of flavorful toppings. It's the way Vincent's has served pizza since it opened nearly 70 years ago. It's also a style that's common with Pittsburgh pies.
There's often way more cheese on a Pittsburgh pizza than there are in most pizzas almost anywhere else that I've ever been.
That's Rico Galliano, a freelance journalist and Pittsburgh native, who's written about Pittsburgh-style pizza.
And then the other thing I would say is the crust, which tends to be pretty hearty. And it depends, of course, on the pizza joint. But I think the standard Pittsburgh pizza crust is it's pretty dense, it's very chewy, and it kind of needs to be.
He says the reason for a dense and hearty pie comes from our steel roots.
Because you've got these guys coming out of the steel mills after working there, 18 or whatever insane number of hour shifts it was, you don't want a thin Neapolitan pie. You want a big honking pile of cheese on top of something like really hearty and doughy to get you through. And that totally explains why Vincent's pies would be the way they are.
Other pizza shops agreed. Pittsburgh pizza is hearty. You gotta have a crust that isn't too thin and be serious with the cheese. Dominic Minio, who owns Minio's in Squirrel Hill, describes it as closer to a New York style, but with its own Pittsburgh flair.
It is, you know, a substantial size crust, and we're not afraid to put the cheese on the pizza. We put a lot of cheese on our pizza.
The other thing that Pittsburgh pizza shop owners say they have in common, high quality ingredients. While we couldn't actually verify the quality of ingredients used in each pie, and many shops didn't want to share proprietary information, they all say they've labored over choosing specific ingredients, so their pizzas end up costing more than chain stores. Of course, there are multiple styles of pizza in Pittsburgh. Galliano points out in his article that our city has the second highest density of pizzerias in the U.S. Only Orlando, Florida has more pizza places per person. So what might make Pittsburgh unique is that you can find whatever you're looking for. Jim Rhodes says it's those healthy servings of toppings at Vincent's. He's been coming since he was a kid.
They don't skimp. They got tons of stuff on it. It's just good. I love the crust is phenomenal. It's just something a little different and unique. It's not the standard everyday chain pizzas, you know? So it's just something we grew up with and I love it.
The other thing you have to do at Vincent's, dunk your crust in the grease.
There you go. And see, that's when you get to this crust part, you take that crust and dip it in that. We've been doing this forever.
Zollner says some even take their grease in a to-go cup. I'm Sarah Kovash, 90.5 WESA News.
Need backup cheese, backup pepper.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh is experiencing another day of poor air quality. Following a fire in December at the Clarton Coke Works and quick transitions from sub-zero temps last week to unseasonably warm weather this week, joining me to discuss what this all means for all of us is WESA reporter Kathleen Davis and Deb Gentile, allergy and asthma doctor with the Pediatric Alliance. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Kathleen, let's start with you. Bring us up to speed what officials released late yesterday about Pittsburgh's air for today.
Yeah, so today is another poor air distribution day. We've had a few days lately of poor air quality locally, and that's where air quality is deemed unhealthy. And usually it's for unhealthy for more sensitive groups, so like younger children and the elderly, but
people with respiratory troubles.
But sometimes it gets to a point where it can affect everyone.
Right. And diminished quality due to the Clarton Coke Works site fire and this unusually hot, cold, hot weather. But those are separate issues, right?
Right. So with these temperature fluctuations, what happens is that, well, you know, we had such cold weather about a week ago, and then all of a sudden this warm front moved in. And so that creates what's called an inversion. And that means the cold air is trapped to the ground and with the warm air above it. And that also traps the pollutants close to the ground. And we also didn't really have any wind in the past week. So those pollutants didn't really have a chance to blow away as they usually do.
All right. Deb, poor air quality, it can be bad news for anyone, but it really impacts a number of diseases. What are you most concerned about?
I'm concerned about a variety of populations. You know, we know for sure that this impacts young children because their lungs are developing. The elderly are also at risk. Anyone with any type of respiratory condition, asthma, adults with COPD, older patients with congestive heart failure or any other type of heart disease are at risk for problems. There are studies that have shown exposure to high rates of outdoor air pollutants also increases lifetime risk of cancer, and it increases your risk of dying earlier than expected.
So not just the
today effect of poor air quality, long-term impact?
Long-term impacts. Long-term impacts can affect your health status over years. There are studies that have been done to show that children who grew up near pollution sites have diminished lung function as they're growing. You know, we also know that pregnant women who are exposed to outdoor air pollution, their children are more likely to have asthma as well. Right. And then you have the acute effects. So you have chronic exposure, which is causing some baseline inflammation or swelling when those chemicals are in your lungs, and we can get into that more in a minute. But when you have these exacerbations of exceedances, that definitely triggers acute attacks.
All right. Kathleen, have county or state officials recommended any specific action for people who live in the Pittsburgh area due to this another poor dispersion distribution day?
Well, yesterday, Allegheny County Council met with the health department to express their concerns about the health of residents. And then today there's going to be a state legislative hearing on air quality in Clareton. And there will be some Democratic lawmakers there to hear from the public about how they're affected. As far as I know, no real real asks from either of these parties. I think right now they're sort of just gathering information.
All right. Deb, are there certain precautions people with the health concerns should take, not just on a daily basis, but on these poor air quality days?
There definitely are. One of the first things that we do is if you do fall one of these high-risk categories with respiratory, heart, young child, or older patients, anyone like that should try to limit their outdoor activities, particularly as it relates to exercise. We know if you are on medications to control your asthma, you definitely want to make sure you're taking them right now, and you also want to have your rescue medications handy in case you do have a problem.
Deb, you've been following some kids in Clareton, but I want to get to that. And was this before the fire or after the fire?
We've actually been following children, and we've been following children for about 5 years now in the Mon Valley to look at their asthma outcomes. We've studied about 1,200 kids so far that live near point sources of pollution. Over 200 of those kids are from Clareton. Mm-hmm. And what we found overall is their rate of asthma is more than double the national and state rate. We're finding a rate of 22% of asthma in these kids. Nationally, the rate's 9. Statewide, it's 10. Mm-hmm. We're also finding of those that have asthma, their disease is not well controlled. Mm-hmm. 60% of the kids we found have poorly controlled asthma, which means they're at risk for attacks. And that compares to a 40% rate, again, across the nation and state. So we see more absence and more poor outcomes with these children.
All right. And remind us, Kathleen, this fire at the Clareton Coke Works erupted on Christmas Eve day, and it has caused a lot of concern since then. What's the latest, you know?
So with the fire, some pollutant regulating aspects of the plant got destroyed, I guess, or at least they're not working
damaged,
properly.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're damaged. But the plant is still producing coke. And so what a lot of activist groups are asking for is for U.S. Steel to stop production at the plant until things can get fixed up there and the pollutants can be more regulated. And it sounds like U.S. Steel might be able to fix all of their damaged components by May. Mm-hmm. But a lot of groups are saying that's not soon enough.
Right. And there have been calls for a complete shutdown. We've talked to the health department on the confluence and said, well, complete shutdown could just destroy the coke batteries. But other people have been calling for a hot idle. Mm-hmm. And you're nodding, Deb. I mean, is that... would that help?
I think it definitely would help. You know, part of this issue now is we really don't know how much pollution is coming out of there. Some of what was damaged were their internal pollution monitors. And we know we've had these exceedances. This weather is not going to go away. The weather's not the cause of the problem. The weather you know, is going to contribute. But really what's happening is those particulate matters are trapped during those inversions, and that's what's causing the symptoms. So if we know these inversions are coming, could we power these down to some degree without shutting them out? Mm-hmm. I also understand that there are some technologies that could be used to upgrade these facilities in general, to go back to talk to more about that chronic exposure, that we could do better at cutting that down chronically.
Mm-hmm. Have you found that other kids suffer from similar environments as the kids in the Clarton area?
Oh, absolutely. We've done this type of work over in the Woodland Hills area and seen the same outcomes. We actually have a cohort of children that we studied in the Northgate School District both before and after Shenango closed. And we went back about 1 year after Shenango closed, and we saw that their asthma rates had been cut in half, and their level of asthma control had improved by 60% just with that factory closing.
All right. So, Kathleen, you briefly mentioned that state legislative policy, Democratic policy hearing at noon today in the Clarton Municipal Building. Who do we expect to be there?
A few Democratic lawmakers. The only one that I know for sure is Jay Costa, who's a state senator. But our reporter, Amy Sisk, will be there this afternoon, and she will be reporting on what happens.
Right. And I understand, Deb, that you will be testifying. What is the message that you want to tell? Now, these are Democratic lawmakers who will be holding this hearing. What is it you want to get through to them?
Well, I've already met with them once, and they are aware of these children and their pollution problem contributing to asthma. What I'd like to leave with today are three things. One is, if the Allegheny County Health Department needs legislative changes in order to be more effective, we need them to do that.
Okay, so you're saying, I want to follow up on that, because you mentioned Allegheny County Health Department. Are they at any sort of restriction of state law, though, that might restrict them from what they can do?
So again, I'm not an expert on this. I'm a pediatric allergist, but a lot of what I hear is that they have to follow certain laws in order to proceed through the pathway to control this pollution coming out of this factory and plant. If we need the state legislature to do something to enable them, it needs to be done. If we need to do something on the county level, it needs to be done. The second thing that I think we need to do is really let these people talk. The citizens of these areas are the ones that are affected. There need to be town hall meetings so that they can voice what they want. They're the ones that are living there. They're the ones that are exposed. That needs to come out of this. The final thing is, as a physician who does work over there, I was totally caught off guard by this. I wasn't aware of the fire on Christmas Eve. I wasn't aware of the exceedances. I don't go on the Allegheny County Health Department Facebook. I don't think a lot of people do. I think the Allegheny County Health Department realizes they do need to do a better job of communicating. And we can't tell these families that you're going to potentially not be able to allow your kids to go out and play until May. We have to have some solution here. It's very unhealthy for young children to not go outside and be physically active. And to tell them they have to stay in for months on end is not good.
Right. That communication, the Allegheny County Health Department took a big hit in terms of criticism when it came to communicating with the public.
I think they did, but I also think that they are responding. I know they've been meeting with different groups, trying to see what they think better messaging is. I know they've come out with their alerts that you can get the app for and sign up on. I do think I'd like to see this go even a step further, whereas maybe we see it reported on the evening news or in a newspaper.
Right. In our remaining minute, this is, Kathleen mentioned, sort of an information gathering, but you said May. We can't wait till May. When can any action come? When is it needed? What are you expecting out of this hearing? Just information gathering, Kathleen?
I think the information gathering, I mean, if I were a lawmaker and I was, meeting with residents who are directly affected, I think hopefully that would sway me to do something about it. We will see if any action actually comes from it.
And what do you expect really to come from this?
I would really like them to look at considering hot idle. I mean, we're having exceedances. Some of this more recent exceedance was over in Braddock, and they think that's related to, you know, flaming over there as a result of the fire. Mm-hmm. We need to be dealing with this proactively. We know this is an inversion day. We need them to decrease their pollution output today, so we're not in these levels.
And hot idle is the fires are still burning.
Correct.
But the coke is not being produced.
Correct.
All right. Deb Gentile is an allergy and asthma specialist with the Pediatric Alliance. Kathleen Davis is a reporter at WESA. Again, our colleague Amy Sisk will be at the hearing in Clareton today. Look for reports from her later today on WESA. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a conversation with longtime Pittsburgh Councilman Reverend Ricky Burgess about balancing the benefits of development in the East End to revitalize the community versus fears of gentrification. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, along with Meg Fair, production assistants from Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of the program, Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.